we're still working, but I just want to get this out of the way. Have you ever heard somebody talk about making an 11th hour decision? You heard that expression? It means deciding something or doing something at the very, very last possible moment, just before it's too late. And Jesus' parable of the workers in the vineyard is actually where that expression first began, where it came from. I've always enjoyed this parable, probably because it upsets so many people, which gives a preacher or a teacher a lot to talk about. This parable challenges everything that we think about the way things should work. It confirms everything that we've been told about God. It convicts and calls for a change in us. And I guess points one and three are why so many of us get uncomfortable with this particular parable, because we humans don't much like being challenged or convicted or called to change. All of Jesus' parables, his teaching stories, used everyday life experiences, things they were familiar with, the people that he first told them to, and they almost always had some little twist, some surprising thing that they would have found shocking. For example, if you remember the parable of the prodigal son, the son insulted his father by demanding his inheritance while the father was still alive. He wasn't willing to wait for his dad to die to get the money. He wanted it now. And then he took the money and he ran. He abandoned his father, his responsibilities, his culture, his upbringing, even his religion. And he squandered the inheritance, we are told, in loose living in a pagan land. And what would have made the listeners gasp when they first heard that parable was that when that son came home, and he mostly came home because he was hungry, he was starving, he was out of money, he had no place else to go, and the father, who had every reason to disown him and to turn away from him, ran to greet that son. That wayward, ungrateful, embarrassing son, and he embraced him, and he forgave him, and he reinstated him as a son. And then he threw a big party in celebration that he had come home. And that was something the older brother in the parable, who had faithfully stayed with the father and worked hard and long the whole time, that older brother resented that. Much like the workers who were hired first in today's parable, who resented how that turned out too. And in that parable, the workers in the vineyard, the shocking, that's not how it's supposed to work thing is when the owner of the vineyard pays the workers who worked only an hour the same thing that he paid those who had worked harder and longer, including those who had labored what would have been a 12-hour day. In a Bible study at Grace once, one of the participants, who happened to be a young lawyer, he just got indignant about this parable. And he said, "That's unfair. It's not good business. It's an employee relations disaster. It's a lawsuit waiting to happen," which may all be true from a human perspective, but it is also, according to Jesus, the way things are, the way things operate in the kingdom of heaven. And by extension, that's how they should operate in the church, which is the kingdom of heaven on earth. The worker who complained to the vineyard owner was just as indignant. If labor relations attorneys had been available back in his day, he would have hired someone like that young lawyer in the Bible study to represent him and the others who were hired first in what we now call a class action suit, and they probably would have won. He says to the owner, "You've paid us, who have worked all day, doing the bulk and the brunt of the labor through the heat of the whole day, the same, as you've paid those who were hired last and only worked an hour. And we are told he grumbled about it. And then perhaps revealing the real source of his irritation, the truest, deepest, darkest feelings of his heart, he goes on and he says, "You've made them equal to us." Oh, more about that later. In regard to the parable of the workers in the vineyard, Andy Stanley, his father, Charles Stanley, like his father, Charles Stanley, he's a pastor, he's a preacher, he's an author. And he makes this point about what's fair and what's unfair. People only complain about things being unfair when unfair works against them, Stanley says. When unfairness works to my advantage, I call that answered prayer. How do you respond when you get more than your fair share of something good, he says. Do you turn it down? Of course not. You are like me. You thank God and you keep on moving before somebody changes his mind. I bet you've never said, "No fair, my piece of cake is bigger than yours." Stanley sums up amazing fairness, unfairness of grace by saying, if fair means that I get what I deserve, then I don't really want fair. I would opt for grace instead. Grace is amazing because it is absolutely, entirely free and unmerited and unwanted and undeserved. It is the gift of God. It's not always accepted, but it is always unconditionally, equally, undeservedly, unfairly offered to everybody and anybody. John Newton knew this. He was a hard and heartless, immoral man who lived a very sordid, sinful life, and he made his living as a slave trader and a slave ship captain. Ship like that, where they're unloading the cargo, the human cargo, from the hold of the ship. And Newton made a lot of money at it, and he profited off the ministry, misery of others. And then he came face to face with God's offer of grace in the midst of a terrifying storm at sea that had been battering the ship he was in. It was a slave ship, but ironically, there'd been an uprising, and John Newton had been taken captive and was a slave in the slave ship. And the storm had been battering this slave ship for days. And that's when he came face to face with God's grace. It was an offer that he had in no way earned or deserved or expected from a God he never really believed in and had always ignored anyway. Well, he was saved from that storm and he was saved from that captivity. And he accepted that totally undeserved grace. And Newton gave up the slave trade. And he gave all of his ill-gotten wealth to charity. And he became a clergyman in a small, poor, rural church. And he lived a life of poverty and of service. And he began to work tirelessly in the movement to have slavery abolished in England, where he lived. And he wrote one of the most beloved hymns of all times, in which he testified, you know it, "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost, but now I'm found. Was blind, but now I see." How unfair of God to offer salvation and redemption and new direction and purpose and even honor to a wretched man like that. When, you know, all of us good people know that it should be reserved for those who have lived their lives in righteousness and service, right? And are more deserving. And yes, it's amazingly unfair that Newton was given a way to serve God and that he is remembered today, not for his sinfulness and not for his unworthiness, but as the writer of such a beautiful hymn. But that's exactly why it's called grace. It isn't fair. It isn't deserved. It is simply, purely, completely, amazingly a gift of God. Well, you might say, Newton did change, and he gave up his old life, and he spent the rest of his life in service to God and others. So maybe he did deserve God's grace at the end. Maybe he had earned it after all. But how about this? Jesus hangs dying in agony on a cross with a thief, a criminal on either side. And at first, both of them join with the crowd in mocking Jesus. And one of them says, if you're the Messiah, come down off of that cross and save yourself and us. But at what is about as 11th hour a decision as you can make, having seen Jesus suffer, having heard him forgive those responsible, one of the thieves changes his mind very shortly before he dies. Don't you fear God, he asks the other criminal. We are getting what we deserve, but this man is innocent. And then he turns to Jesus, and knowing he doesn't deserve anything at all, he doesn't even have, you know, the courage to ask for salvation and forgiveness. He just says, Jesus, will you remember me when you come into your kingdom? And what does Jesus do? How does he respond to this man who has lived his whole life outside of and away from God? This man who doesn't have a single thing on his to balance the scales on his side, a single thing to offer in his own defense. This man who hasn't done a single thing to earn or deserve even the tiniest bit of mercy from God, and has no time left to change or do a single thing to even deserve a response from God. Well, when every breath is a painful struggle, Jesus turns toward that man, not away from that man. And he says, I can do better than that. I tell you the truth. Tonight you will be with me in paradise. Is it fair that Jesus, completely innocent and perfect, would suffer and die for a man like that criminal? Invite someone like him at such a last-minute moment to be with him in his kingdom, to promise to make that a reality for him, for someone like that? No, it is amazingly unfair, not just when Jesus suffered for that sinner, but when he suffered for each and all of us sinners too. It is a totally free and completely undeserved gift to all of us, and that's why it's called grace. So you can see why this parable confronts why the way things work in the kingdom of God and the kingdom of heaven contradicts everything that we humans think about what is right and fair and the way we think things should work. But how does the story in which the vineyard owner represents God, how does that confirm what we know about him? Well, obviously, the story and its outcome, its surprise ending, confirms the truth of a declaration God made through the prophet Isaiah. My thoughts are not your thoughts. My ways are not your ways. My thoughts and my ways are much higher than yours. Whether it's God in the Old Testament choosing Moses to lead his people to freedom, or the shepherd boy David to be Israel's king, or Jesus in the New Testament calling Peter and Andrew and James and John from their fishing boats, and Matthew from his tax table, and Saul from his hate-filled mission to arrest Christians, and as we just discussed in Bible study, a sinful, outcast Samaritan woman from her well. Like the vineyard owner in this parable, God tirelessly, personally pursues and goes out of his way to meet and chooses, invites, calls, and empowers those nobody else would hire to do his kingdom work in the world, something that I am reminded of every time I do this. The parable also portrays a God who keeps his promises. Now, in the NIV version, it calls the payment a denarius, which was a Roman coin. And the vineyard owner says he's going to pay the first worker it hired a denarius, which was considered in that time a full day's wage. I don't know what that would be today. Sufficient to provide for their daily bread, which we are told to pray for one day at a time, and meet the needs of that worker and his family for that day. And so the workers hired first, early in the morning when the sun came out. They agreed to that. They thought they were getting a good deal. That's exactly what the vineyard owner paid them. Just what they asked for. Just what he promised. So he told the workers hired later, come work for me in my vineyard and I'll pay you whatever is right. And that's exactly what he did. Because what the generous and compassionate vineyard owner, who represents God, thought was right, was also the denarius that would meet the needs of those workers and supply what they needed for their family for that day, whether they had earned it or not, even those hired at the 11th hour. The parable also confirms what we should know but too often forget. Like that vineyard owner, God is the owner of everything. Jesus does the calling. God is the one who makes the decisions. God is the one who decides who to invite to work in his kingdom, what work they're going to do, and what they're going to receive from him, not us. We are not recruited and called and expected by God to be the human resources reference checkers. Let's see if you got the background and the skills and let's see if you get in to do this work of heaven. What God is calling and expecting us to do and to be is his welcome committee, his new worker training and support team, his cheerleaders, all of us equally his workers, each with a job that he has given us to do. You know, we started with a list of C words, confronts, confirms, convicts, calls. And I think there are a few more C words that we need to consider this morning. Compare, compete, complain, covet, criticize. First of all, Scripture makes it clear that we are not to waste our time or God's time or anybody else's time comparing ourselves to others. Our work, our success, our worth, our status to theirs. For example, before he ascended back to heaven, in a totally undeserved act of pure grace, Jesus, the risen Jesus, reinstates to a significant role in ministry, Peter, who had done what? Denied him 3 times. And then Jesus tells Peter what's going to happen to him, and that foreshadows what the church has handed down as the story of Peter's own crucifixion, supposedly being crucified upside down because he didn't think himself worthy to die the same way as Christ. So after hearing all that, Peter sees John come and walking toward him. And so Peter sees John and he says to Jesus, well, what about him? And Jesus tells Peter, that's not your concern. What happens to John, what happens between Christ and John is between Christ and John. And Peter need only be concerned about himself and his own relationship with Christ. Peter need only be focused on doing the kingdom work that Jesus has created and called him, Peter, to do. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, the Apostle Paul tells the people of the church in Corinth that divisions and jealousies are among them are a sign that their faith is immature and it's not growing the way it should be. And he references a man from Antioch named Apollos, who was a recent convert to Christianity, and he'd been teaching and spreading the gospel and leading people to faith in Jesus Christ. And since he himself became a Christian. Well, some of those who followed Paul, who started that church in Corinth, and so he had been doing the work there from the beginning, and so had they. And they considered Apollos to be an interloper, a Johnny come lately, or an Apollos come lately, and perhaps as a threat to them. And they wanted to go and tell Apollos to cease and desist, to make him stop. But you know what Paul said? He said, no. He said, the problem isn't that there are two of us preaching the gospel of Jesus Christ. The more, the better. The problem is that people here are taking sides, and it's dividing what should always be a united body of Christ. Paul says, what after all is Apollos, and what is Paul? Only servants through whom you came to believe. As the Lord assigned to each his task, I planted the seed, Paul says. Apollos watered it, but God has been making it grow. So neither the one who plants nor the one who waters is anything, but only God who makes things grow. And Paul made it very clear that he and Apollos were not competitors. We are co-workers in God's service, Paul says. It's the same with us. What each of us do, whether we do the same kingdom work or we do different kinds of kingdom work, all the work that we do is God's work. And it's to be done for the same purpose, the building and the strengthening of God's kingdom on earth and the harvesting of souls for his eternal kingdom in heaven. All that we do, anything that we do, is the gracious gift and the calling and the empowerment of God for each of us, though in different roles and in different ways, as God decides. What each of us will be held accountable for by God, and by God's grace we will be helped to do, is how we've faithfully used the opportunities and the background and the experience and the gifts that he's given us, each of us, to do the work that he's created and called each of us to do. In the church, we are co-workers. Different talents, different tools, different tasks, but all workers. None more important than any other, none more valuable to God than any other, no work more for the kingdom more important than any other, no work for the kingdom more valuable than any other. It's all just part of the work that needs done. And that brings us to the convicting and change-calling parts of this parable. So we go back to the two guys who are looking at their pay. If we are making comparisons between our work and the work of others and their work, we shouldn't be. If we are acting like we are in competition with others who happen to be doing the same kind of work we're doing, we shouldn't be. If we are jealous of what other people have been gifted or called to do, or self-servingly proud of what we have been called to do and how well we think we're doing it, we shouldn't be. If we, like the workers hired first, are discontent and angry and bitter about what we've been given by God, or we feel we deserve more and somebody else deserves less, or if it's a matter of us versus them, if we're grumbling and rather than being grateful, we shouldn't be. Because all of that is a serious sin of the heart. It's a breaking of the commandment not to covet. It's a dissatisfaction and a distraction that divides us one from another, and it threatens to destroy the church of Jesus Christ. And it's an obstacle to the spread of the gospel and the saving work of God in the world. If we are criticizing the work of others and their work instead of helping them get the work done and helping them to do it better, we shouldn't be. And if we are wasting our gifts, we're letting everybody else do the work, and we're wasting our gifts, and we're ignoring God's call on our lives, we shouldn't be. You heard a little bit earlier, we need workers for the barbecue, the, you know, whatever. So even if it's, you know, serving a meal and it's whatever, workers are needed, and you do what you can. Because if we're not doing our part, then there is some part of the work of God that is not being done as he created and called only us to do it. Something that's not going to be done the way he intended it to be done, because he really wanted us to have the privilege of doing it. In the story of the worker of the vineyard, workers in the vineyards, who do you think is the most grateful of these two guys? The worker hired first or the worker hired last? Doug would say who? The worker hired last. Because they knew from the get-go that they had gotten far more than they had any reason to expect, far more than they deserved, solely and completely by the amazing generosity, the amazing unfair grace of the vineyard owner. But those other guys, the ones hired first, if they had only taken the time to consider and realize, those hired first had also received grace upon grace. They had been hired right away. Have you ever needed a new job and had trouble finding a new job and you didn't know where the new job was coming from? Then you know what this is like. And they had been hired immediately at the beginning of the day. And they didn't have to stand around and like those who were hired later, and they were so jealous of, and they didn't want to be treated as their equal. And they didn't have to stand around worrying about whether they would have to go home empty-handed with nothing to feed their families. Other men who were just workers like themselves, whose stories, whose reasons for being late to the hiring place, whatever they were, they didn't know and they didn't care about. Yes, those first hired workers had worked all day through the heat of the day, but the vineyard owner had gone out over and over and over again to find and bring in more help to make their load lighter and to help get the work done. And they had received exactly the pay that they'd negotiated, that they'd agreed upon, that they'd expected. They had not been cheated. In the NIV, I think the owner says, I have not treated you unfairly. And just as we are truly blessed and privileged to work for our compassionate and generous God, they got to work for a truly wonderful vineyard owner. All of the vineyard owners weren't like that. And this was a man who still called the spokesperson, the angry spokesperson of those hired first, he still called him friend when he was angry and making accusations toward him. Just as, by the way, Jesus still called Judas friend. In the Garden of Gethsemane, when Judas came to betray him. Pure, unadulterated, amazingly unwarranted, unmerited, unfair grace in both cases, as it is when Jesus still calls us friend, no matter what we've done or failed to do. You know, we humans are a funny lot. In the parable about the worker in the vineyard, we people in the church tend to think of ourselves as, well, we're the workers who were hired fairly early in the day, and, you know, we've been laboring hard and long, and we've been doing the work, and therefore we've earned or we deserve what we receive from God. It's our just reward. But if we had to work for it, if we had to earn it, if we had to deserve it before we got it, even if that was the least bit possible, which it is not, none of it would be grace. And whether we realize it or not, almost all of us are actually the workers hired late and last, each of us being faithfully, persistently, personally pursued by a God who was not content to leave us outside his kingdom. You know, each personally invited to be part of God's redemptive work in the world and in us, at what God knew was for each of us the 11th hour. You know, whether early or late in our lives, we've all been brought in by a gracious, loving God at the moment we were the most hopeless, the most likely to just keep on going in the wrong direction and end up lost, like the Apostle Paul on the way to Damascus. I kind of like this picture. He's on his way to arrest Jews who'd become Christians, and he was thinking he was doing the work of God in doing that. He was working for God. And the risen Christ catches up to him and knocks him literally off his high horse. And then ironically, he blinds him so that he can see the truth. In testifying about that, Paul called himself the worst of sinners, a blasphemer, a violent man, a murderer. And he knew he was saved only undeservedly by the grace of God and given undeservedly work to do in the kingdom that he had tried to destroy and to take God's love, ironically, to the Gentiles that he had always hated and thought were beyond the reach of God's mercy and deserving and care and salvation. And then, not because he was trying to deserve God's grace, but because he had already undeservedly received God's grace, Paul went on to travel tirelessly for years, evangelizing and starting churches over the vast Roman Empire. And he wrote most of the letters in the New Testament, and in prison, in fact. And he suffered and he died for his faith in the gospel in Jesus Christ as his Lord and Savior. And I'm glad there's no comparison, because here's the amazing and unfair thing. Each of us whose faith and zeal and tireless work and effectiveness and courage in the face of persecution could in no way ever match Paul's, each of us have been offered exactly the same grace that he has received. Each of us has been given the same forgiveness and salvation, redemption, redirection, new purpose and meaning, the ability to see the truth of Jesus Christ, the absolutely, completely undeserved privilege of working and participating in the work of the kingdom to the good of others and to the glory of God. I mean, how amazingly, wonderfully unfair is that? You remember what I said Andy Stanley said? If fair means getting what I deserve, I don't really want fair. I would opt for grace instead. So would I, and I have a feeling so would you. You know, amazing grace, we don't deserve it. We can't buy it. We can't earn it. We don't have to. It is the absolutely free, unmerited gift of a generous God who offers and gives it to us out of love for us. And that's why it's called grace. Thanks be to God.